Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to Torah Studies, our weekly journey into the soul of the Torah portion. So this week's Torah portion is Shemini. It's post-Pesach, and we're back to the regular schedule of Torah portion classes. Okay, here you go. The Torah portion talks about many themes, and you can find it in the Chumash beginning, let's see what page it's on, page 674. So open up, please, to 674. Talks about the day, the eighth day of the inauguration. Shemini means eight. Torah portion begins with a discussion about what happened on the eighth day of the Mishkan, of the Tabernacle's inauguration, the day that the Tabernacle officially opened for business. And of course, as we know, on that day, a tragedy happened. Aaron, who's the high priest, his two sons, Nadav, well, he had four sons, but his two oldest sons, Nadav and Avihu, They brought an offering that the Torah says was an offering. It's called a Esh Zara, which means a foreign fire. They brought that, and it says that a fire came down from heaven and consumed them, and they passed away. So that's a tragic story that mars, if you will, the celebration of the Mishkan's opening. At that point, the Torah's narrative on 678 and 679. On the next page, the Torah talks about the laws of mourning during priestly service, which is appropriate because Aaron was in mourning, so it was a direct commandment to him about how to behave, how to respond to the tragedy that happened. The Torah then continues with a resumption of the service on that day after their passing, and then it totally switches gears. On page 687, it's almost like a tale of two portions, if you will. In 687, the Torah portion switches to a discussion of kosher and non-kosher. So we have the Mishkan's inauguration, the celebration, the offerings, the tragedy, and then switching gears, let's talk about dinner. What can you eat? What can't you eat? So it talks about kosher animals and non-kosher animals. Hey, it talks about kosher, so that 687 is kosher animals and non-kosher animals, 689, fish, right? So you have your animals, your meat, then you have your fish, what's kosher fish, what's not kosher fish, then you have the birds on 691, and you have the insects, what insects are good and what insects are not good, and as many of us know, the signs for a kashrut depend on the type of substance or the type of being that we're talking about. So if it's an animal, so an animal requires two signs to be kosher. Number one, split hooves. And number two, it has to chew its cud. So it has to have both of those, so to speak, signs in order to be kosher. Famously, the rabbis discuss what is the nature of one of these kosher signs. Is it just telling us that the animal is kosher? In other words, it's indicative that the animal is kosher, or do these signs actually render it kosher? In other words, is the animal kosher because it has split hooves and chews its cud, or is it kosher, but how do you know if it has split hooves and chews its cud? Now, it sounds like a subtle distinction, but it has far-reaching implications. Anyway, so that's the point. That's with regards to the kosher signs of animals. When it comes to fish, fins and scales, also two signs, fins and scales. So in the intermediary days of Passover, so as we know, many of the holidays have opening days and closing days that are formal holiday days, and then the middle days are called Chol HaMoed, which is, it's kind of a contradiction in terms. It means the mundane within the holiday. So it's the intermediary days in which work is permitted and all that stuff. So we actually took a family trip up to Chattanooga. Anybody been to Chattanooga? Great city. Fabulous city. Especially for kids.
Aquarium.
Yes. That's where I'm going with the fish. So we saw lots of fish, and the kids were like, wait a second, I see scales, I see fins. I'm like, looks like a hammerhead shark. I don't think that's kosher. I don't know if what you're seeing are actually scales. Maybe it's like lost in the translation between all that glass and, you know, all the other reflections. But anyway, we had a very fun time observing the fish, so I just reminded myself of the fish, talking about fish. So anyway, the kosher signs of a fish are fins and scales. And again, that makes either that indicates that the fish is kosher, or that actually makes it kosher and it's a deeper sense of a sign. And then we have birds. The Torah describes which birds are off limits. It doesn't tell us the sign of kosher birds. It just lists the non-kosher birds. And the commentaries explain that all the non-kosher birds, what they have in common, is that they're all birds of prey. That's P-R-E-Y, not birds of tefillah, not birds of that type of prey. No, these are birds of prey, aggressive birds. The Ramban, Nachmanides says famously that why don't we eat birds of prey? Because you are what you eat. And therefore, we don't want to imbibe, take in, digest, absorb that type of aggressive nature of the bird of prey. Therefore, those are off limits. Okay, and then it talks about forbidden and permitted insects, and basically insects in general are not kosher. Sorry to spoil anyone's fun with the insect consumption, except the Torah says that there are certain types of locusts, grasshoppers, locusts that are kosher, and the way it is in practice today, most Jewish communities, most Jewish groups say that we do not know which of these locusts are kosher. There are some, I've heard Yemenite Jews, some Jews that say that they have an ancient tradition which ones are kosher. That's if you seek to eat a locust. Then the Torah segues into laws of ritual impurity from non-kosher animals. So this is not about eating the animal, but this is about the ritual impurity coming in contact with these non-kosher animals. And then it talks about in 693 laws of ritual impurity of objects and food. And then we get to more kosher discussion. So I want to point out how this is framed. You have animals, kosher and non-kosher animals, fish, birds, insects. Then we put kashrut, we put the kosher discussion aside. We talk about tum and tara, purity and impurity. Then it gets back to kosher, gets back to eating. So you're with me? Discussion about eating, impurity, and then on 695, after a little bit of an intermission, it once again resumes the discussion about what is kosher to eat. So let's pick it up. Ray, please open up to page 695, verse 41. Verse 41, bottom third of the page. Please read verses 41. Yes, just the first two verses there, 41 and 42. Any creeping.
Okay. Right. Any creeping creature that creeps on the ground is an abomination. It must not be eaten or fed to others.
So again, see here that after the discussion about touching things and becoming impure, we're once again back into the consumption conversation. Okay, continue.
You must not eat any snake or worm that goes on its belly, and any scorpion that walks on four legs, or any centipede that has many legs, and all creeping creatures that creep on the ground, including the beetle family, for they are an abomination.
Even the beetles are non-kosher.
A couple of them are.
Yeah. All right. So that is a quick rundown about additional creatures that are not kosher. Okay, so we have here the snake, the worm, the scorpion, the centipede, and the beetles, and other such similar things. Okay, so let's jump into the Torah Studies text. Torah Studies text has a little bit of a different translation. So Ray, if you don't mind, do me a favor and please read text 2A. Text 2A on page number 5 of the Torah Studies book.
That goes on its belly, and any creature that walks on four legs, to any creature that has many legs, among all creeping creatures that creep on the ground, you shall not eat, for they are an abomination.
Now this is a more literal translation. The one that we read had the parentheses, which is Rashi, which is found in text, well, it's derived from text 2b. So please continue. Text 2b, the Talmud explains what the verse means, because if you look at the verse, it doesn't actually specify which creatures it's talking about. It says anything that goes on its belly, anything that walks on four, anything that has many legs, don't eat. So what goes on its belly, what walks, it sounds like a riddle, right? What goes on its belly, walks on four, and has many legs. Okay, these are three different things. The Talmud deciphers it. Now we know the answer, because we read the Gunnik edition that has the parentheses of Rashi, which are derived from this Talmudic piece, but let's see it in its source. Ray, one more text. Maybe we'll give you even more. But text 2b for now.
The rabbis taught in the Berenka, any creature that goes on its belly refers to a snake. The word, any, teaches us to include an earthworm in the prohibition.
Let me explain that. The Torah says, kol holech al gachon, everything or anything that goes on its belly. So, if it would have just said, that which goes on its belly, that means a snake. The fact that it says anything is an inclusive term. It's not just a snake, it says anything. It must mean the snake plus. So the Talmud says, earthworm. Continue.
Any creature that walks on four refers to a scorpion. Any creature that has many legs refers to a centipede. The word any teaches us to include in the prohibition those that resemble them and those that resemble those that resemble them.
You see that the Talmud says, continues to say that when it says ad kol, where is that? It says ad kol, until all that have many legs. I don't know if it's translated that way.
Profiling.
Huh?
They're profiling.
Yes, they're profiling. Yeah. Right, and what's the profile? Anything like this? Or anything like anything that's like this? So anything in this genre, anything in the belly genre, in the four-leg genre, in the many-leg genre, don't eat. That's what the Torah says. Any insects, not four-legged cows. I mean, that's we already have that before, a few pages before. Okay, good. Now let's talk about the snake. Let's talk about the snake. That's going to be our main character tonight. Here's a spoiler alert. It's all about the snake from this point on. The snake is referred to as kol holech agachon. The Torah doesn't say that the nachash is snake, right? Nachash, snake. The Torah does not say the nachash should not be eaten. It says kol holech agachon, anything that goes on its belly. So why doesn't it say snake? Okay, we're gonna ask that question soon. But let's address the idea, the notion that it goes on its belly. Because that, in any translation of the Torah that you'll see, you'll find holech al gachon, those three words, holech al gachon, as meaning going, holech means moving, al upon, gachon, it's belly. And yet, Rashi says, it's a mistranslation. One more text, Ray, text 2c, Rashi, page 6.
That goes on its belly. This is the snake. The word gachon,
yes,
denotes bending low and is used to describe the snake because it moves while bent in a prostrated posture, prostrated on its belly.
Rashi says gachon does not mean belly. When it says kol alech agachon, it doesn't mean anything that goes on its belly, like a snake that slithers. It still refers to a snake, but that's not what gachon means in Hebrew. Gachon means rather that which is bent low. So look what he writes. He says, gachon denotes bending low because it moves while bent over, prostrated on its belly. So it's bent over and it's on its belly. That's what gachon literally means. Okay, good. Now, where do we find this term gachon for the first time in Torah? This is not the first time that we have gachon mentioned in context of the snake. Where do you think gachon is found? Where do we have the snake previously in Torah? The most famous episode?
Adam and Eve.
Adam and Eve. Right? Who convinces Eve, who then convinces Adam to eat of the forbidden fruit? The snake. Sometimes it's translated as serpent. It doesn't really matter. Snake, serpent, whatever. We're not getting all... Oh, so hold on 1 second. That's what we're about to study. So let's turn back. Let's turn back to the book of Bereishis. Let's go all the way back to the beginning. This is the second chapter of Genesis. You can find this on page number 21. Page 21. Take a look at this. You see there halfway down where it says the sin of the tree of knowledge on 21? Okay. The Torah talks about the sin. Actually, chapter 3. Look at that. Torah says, man and his wife, they were not wearing clothes. They were not ashamed. They had no... They didn't know what they didn't know. They were just pure and innocent. Then we're introduced, chapter 3 of Genesis, we're introduced to the Nachash. In the Hebrew, Chapter 3, the third chapter of Bereshit says, V'hanachash, and the snake, or and the serpent, was cunning. And it says, the snake says to Chava, to Eve, did God say not to eat? Why do you think God said not to eat? Yeah, you know, he starts convincing her, it's not so bad. It's good. God's afraid if you eat, you're going to become like God, but you want to eat. And so he convinces her to eat from the tree, and then she convinces her husband to eat from the tree, etc. The narrative continues that after they eat, so now they've sinned, God calls them together for a reckoning. And God doles out consequences for each party. For Adam, the punishment is by the sweat. Let's see where this is. Yeah, 25. Let's just see this. Oh, I'm sorry. It's first serpent, then woman, then man. It goes in that order. So first the serpent. But I want to start the other way around. Okay, because I want to build up to the serpent. So let's start from the man. So the man, the curse of Adam is you will toil. Where is it? The ground will be cursed before you, and you will toil to eat from it all the days of your life. It's not going to be easy. Before the sin, the earth was supposed to produce. You ever see like these like musicals or like these kind of musical scenes? And they have the fountains, you know, the person's walking, and all the fountains are like jumping before them, and everything is responding, and they're walking, and the flowers are blooming in front. Right, that's the way it was supposed to work. The Garden of Eden, Gan Eden, was supposed to respond perfectly to Adam and Chava, to the human being. In other words, the earth was supposed to serve mankind on his and her mission on earth. Because why wouldn't it? If we have a mission, God's creating everything to support our mission, so why wouldn't it intrinsically, naturally, inherently respond in a pure fashion? But it doesn't. It doesn't because of this curse, this sin. This sin caused about it that the earth should be sealed off. You want something out of me? You're going to have to dig me up. You have to plant. You'll have to water, sunlight, and still it might not grow. So many different factors to get it to grow. You're going to have to use a lot of chachma, a lot of wisdom, a lot of effort, toil, schwitz. You're going to have to sweat. By the sweat of your brow, you're going to eat. So that's Adam's curse. Eve's curse is that bearing children will be difficult, will be painful. By the way, I've heard some people say that's a proof that you shouldn't get an epidural. Because it says, it says for Eve that her curse, the consequence for her is that it should be painful. And my response to that is, even with the epidural, there's still plenty, it's still not an easy thing. In other words, some people are like, no, the Torah says you have to be a purist. It's like the Rebbe once said about those who say that it's not kosher to go to the moon, because in the Kiddush Levana, the prayer, when we thank God for the moon once a month, there's a prayer, not to that we don't pray to anything else, obviously that's not Judaism. We pray to God for the moon and the moon's light, so we say, Kishem Shani Roke Kenegdech Ve'eni Yachal Ngoyabach Kach La Yuchlu Kala Oivan Ngoyabi Lera. Just like we stand, you know, by the moon, we face east, you know, toward Jerusalem, but we stand under the moonlight, and we say, and we bounce on our toes, and we say, just like we can't reach the moon, we can't touch that, so too may all of our enemies not be able to touch us for harm. So it's like a formula of prayer. So some wanted to say, aha, look at this. You're saying you can't touch the moon. So Judaism says, Treif, it's not a good mission. We shouldn't go to the moon. The Rebbe said, we're not saying you can never go to the moon. We say you can't go to the moon by bouncing on our feet. If anybody can figure out how to get to the moon from jumping, then we have an issue. But until then, it's fine to take a rocket ship. It's not like... So what I'm saying is that's kind of a misnomer, in my opinion, about the... Well, it says Eve should have... The women should have pain in childbirth. I don't think that's a... That's a non-starter as far as that, how to interpret that. But anyway, that's Adam and that's Eve. And what about the snake? So the snake, the Torah says, the snake's curse is as follows. Page 25. Mike, please read this one. Third paragraph in where it says, God Almighty God.
God Almighty God said to the serpent, because you have done this, you are now cursed more than all the cattle and more than all the wild animals of the field. You will have your legs cut off so that you shall walk on your belly, You shall eat soy all the days of your life. I shall place hatred between you and between the woman you desire, and between your descendants and between her descendants. Man will crush you on the road, and you will bite his heel.
On the head. Man will crush you on the head, and you will...
Oh, you will crush... Man will crush you on the head, and you will bite his heel?
Yeah. So that means, like, you know, people will step on snakes, and snakes will bite people's legs. I mean, that's like kind of the arrangement that we have, you know, ever since. Okay, so what do we see from here? We see that the Torah uses the phrase, you shall walk on your belly. Which word do you think that is? Gachon, the same word. Just like we had over here when it comes to kosher. Don't eat anything that goes on its gachon. And we said it either means belly or more precisely that which is kind of leaning toward the ground. This is the first instance where we have snake and belly colliding. The Torah says, after the sin, God says to the snake, now, al gachoncha, it's a form of gachon, on your gachon, on your either belly or bowing down, you will now go and you'll eat of the dust, etc. Now, let me take, so that's how we know, that's how the Talmud knows, that's how Rashi knows, that this that when the Torah says you can't eat anything that goes on its gachon, it means don't eat a snake. Because that's the association between that and this story. Now, parenthetically, I want to share with you some of the drama that went down with a snake. Because there's a fundamental question on the story in Genesis. And that is, what was the snake's agenda? What did the snake want? Why is it enticing Chava and Adam and Eve to sin? What was in it for the snake? What was it? There's even more to it. Text 4, Marnin, please read this one. Talmud Tractate Sota, page number 8. There's a lot of drama here. Text 4, where it says the sage is taught in a brayta.
The sage is taught in a brayta. Anyone who places his eyes on that which is not his is not given what he desires, and that which he is taken, which he had is taken from him.
So, in other words, if you seek, if you pursue what's not yours, not only do you not get it, but you lose what you had. Continue.
And so we find with the primeval snake who placed his eyes on that which was unfit for him because he wanted to marry Eve.
Ah, that's the key point here. He wanted Eve. He wanted to get rid of Adam. Continue.
Consequently, that which he desired was not given to him, and that which was in his possession was taken from him. The Holy One blessed him, he said, I initially said that the snake would be king over every animal and beast. And now he is cursed more than all the animals and beasts of the field. I initially said that the snake would walk upright, but now it should go in his belly. I said that his food would be the same as the food eaten by a person. But now he shall eat dust. The snake said, I will kill Adam and marry Eve. But now I will put enmity between you and the woman and between your seed and her seed.
So, here we have a biblical or a Talmudic origin for women disliking snakes. Women not being into snakes. So this is, the snake wanted Eve. Not only do you not get her, you lose everything that you had, all the greatness that you had, and she's not going to like you anyway. Okay, so that's the deal. What we see from this Talmudic passage is something fascinating. And that is that the original snake walked upright and was supposed to eat people food. And I guess had the ability to communicate on some level. Maybe. Who knows? Talk, yeah. There was some sort of conversation, right? It says, it said to the woman, Vayomer Isha. This is the only animal talking. Could we pause here for a second? I don't think I've thought about this until now. Huh? Yeah, aside from the miraculous, it says that God opened, when it comes to Balaam's donkey, the Torah says God opened his mouth, or her mouth. It was a female donkey. Yeah. He said, God opened her mouth. Doesn't say that God opened up the mouth of the serpent. Serpent, it's like taken for granted. Of course it could speak. It seems like it's some sort of, I don't know, some sort of snake. Who knows what it looked like? Huh?
A parrot snake
that walks upright and eats real food. And wanted to marry Eve. And, you know, I think Mary is being used, like, you know, loosely, right? So, but the point over here is that the snake not only did not get what it wanted, but it lost everything, and part of what it lost is, of course, its ability to walk, and thus it forever slithers on its belly.
Its position in the world.
Correct. Yeah. In fact, if you want to refer to somebody, in our vernacular, you want to refer to somebody that's not the most upstanding person, you call him a snake. And today's class is called the Snake Oil Salesman. Snake Oil Salesman, of course, refers to those that would peddle fake stuff, yeah.
Well, let me keep in mind that maybe the snake was providing a service, because for man to aspire, well, where do we go to? We want to get to Gan Eden. We want to get to that holy place. And I've heard that man is greater than the angels, because the angels have no will except to do
right.
Good. So the snake's job is that, and how would we know what good is if we hadn't had it somewhere in our DNA?
Right.
So the snake's job was to have us fall so we could get back.
So that our job is to lift ourselves back up, 100% right. The snake's job, though, it's like Mike, is that his name, Mike Rowe, Dirty Jobs? It's a bit, yeah, like that, should, yeah, he's like the construction stuff. It's a bit of a dirty job. Someone's got to do it.
And, but without that, we couldn't aspire, because that's the thing, if we were just, that's how we cocoon all along.
Sure. I mean, that's how we rise through falling. No, 100%. But let's take a look, but it seems like, notwithstanding that it might have been the snake's role, the snake did get punished. So we can't just say that it was due. Somehow it oversteps
some. That's the price you pay. Like,
yeah.
You know, like there's an expression in the Marines, everybody wants to go to heaven, but nobody wants to die.
Right. You got to do the work.
Well, and so what? In a way, the snake did the job, but he
didn't go to heaven. Yeah.
Side note or comment, not that this class is about angels, but I don't really think that, I think it's like an oversimplification to correct me, because I don't really know what to talk about, but an oversimplification that angels like only do good. Like that's, I don't necessarily think that that's...
Depending on which angel.
True.
There are some stories...
Maybe ultimately good, but like in our lives, like, I don't know.
Dirty jobs.
That... Maybe they do things that aren't necessarily directly good.
Let's save that for the angel class, because that's a big discussion.
Sorry.
No, it's a big discussion. There's a big question about if angels have free choice and to what extent can they sin. Some sources indicate that angels don't have any ability to choose and they're purely programmed for good. Some other sources indicate that some angels were punished. The Talmud talks about angels that were punished for doing things that they shouldn't have done. So it becomes a little bit complicated. Kabbalah speaks about it a little bit, but it's a really fascinating topic. But let's... And then, there are the angels that we create. We also create angels. We create good angels, and we create the opposite based on our actions, our words, and our thoughts. So everything that we... All of our experiences create angels as well, which is another form of angels that could then either positively or negatively affect us and our aura, because these are angels that are around us that are being created by our every action and move. Okay, but that's another discussion. Let's bring it back to the snake. And the way our sages, especially the Kabbalistic mystics, especially the mystics, the way they see this whole archetype of the snake is not just the snake once upon a time in the Garden of Eden that got punished, but rather the snake ever since refers to that drive within us that tells us, hey, eat of the forbidden fruit. In other words, that tendency, that desire, that pull, that schlep, that nudge, that poke, whatever it is, that says, hey, look over there, or hey, try this. I know you're not supposed to, but try it anyway. Right? Anything that is in that category is referred to as the snake. In the language of Judaism, it's called the Yetzer Hara, which means the evil inclination. Yetzer means inclination or drive, and Ra is bad. So it's the Yetzer Hara, the evil inclination. It's interesting. So what is a euphemism for the evil inclination? Snake. Debbie, please read text number 5.
The verse states, now the serpent was cunning This refers to the evil inclination.
So the Zohar commenting on Genesis, the verse that introduces us to the snake, chapter 3, the Hanachash, the serpent, was tricky. He was cunning. He was sly. He was a snake. So the Zohar says, who is this snake? Where does this snake exist today? Inside of us. Evil inclination. In fact, the Kabbalah says elsewhere that before the sin, the evil inclination existed outside of the person. There was no inner snake. It's not like Adam and Eve had a temptation innately to eat of the forbidden fruit. That idea was born outside of them. But subsequent, once they ate of the tree, now that snake, if you will, is now inside of us. So we have now an evil inclination that pushes us in a negative direction. Now, so we have the Nachash. So again, we're doing word association or theme association. It's all the same theme, but let's just get everything lined up. So we have, let's start from the beginning. Our Torah portion says, don't eat a snake. Anything that crawls on its belly, don't eat. What is the belly? Snake. We know that from Genesis. Okay? So nothing on the belly, that means snake. What is the snake thematically? The Yetzirah, the evil inclination. Let's ask a few questions on the simple meaning of the verses about the kashrus, and then let's get back to the mystical understanding. Give me a second. So, a few questions. Number one, if the Torah wishes, in our Torah portion, back in Leviticus, if the Torah wishes to forbid snakes, why doesn't it just say, don't eat a snake? And I know the simple answer is because by saying belly, it's more inclusive. Because now it includes not only the snake, but also the earthworm. I get it. It says, kol ha'olech al-gachon, anything that crawls on its belly, not only the gachon that we know, the snake that we know, but also the earthworm. I get it. Nonetheless, it's a question that we can ask. The Torah is still speaking euphemistically. Why not straight out snake? Second of all, why does the Torah move the position of these forbidden things later after the impurity? Why not lump it together with the other stuff? Third question. Why is it referred, according to Rashi, the snake is referred to as something that is bent over? That's a very strange way of describing it. Seems very awkward. Why is it described as being kind of prostrated, bent forward toward the ground? Why doesn't it use a more direct phrase of that in the Hebrew, that which goes on its belly? That's the way we translate it, but that's not the literal word in the Hebrew. Why not? And the last question is, of course, the fourth question, what is the personal message? What is the relevant, timeless message that you and I can apply to our lives today? So to understand this, let's get back to the spiritual themes and the archetypes, if you will, of these characters. The snake is the Yetzirah, the evil inclination. But what is the Yetzirah, what is the evil inclination? Another word for that is Satan. Satan is also, in Judaism, also a euphemism, same synonym, it's like a fault, it's another ID, whatever. So it's the same. It means the same as the Yetzirah, the evil inclination. Take a look at text number 6. Text number 6 is magical. This comes from one of the most fundamental works of Chabad Hasidic philosophy, known as Kuntshus Umayyan, and it is a fabulous work of mysticism and personal character growth. So, here we go. Text number 6, Lali. No, Sharashim actually means the book of, it's the Sefer is the book of roots, like root words in Hebrew? Yeah. Like Shoresh. Shoresh means a root.
Defines the root word shita as divergence. Accordingly, the evil inclination is called Satan, for it causes one to veer from the right path. This is why the Midrash associates the word shita with the word folly is the departure from the way of truth.
So hold on, before you continue, let me continue the word association. You ready? So we have snake. We have belly, or bending down. Snake. Snake equals Yetzer Hara, evil inclination. Evil inclination equals Satan, Satan. And that equals Shita. Satan is Shita. Shita means deviation, turning away, veering off. And Shita is related to the word Shtut, which means folly. Like shtuyot, in Hebrew you say shtuyot, which means like, oh, that's made up, that's just Baba Maisa. So shtut, which is folly, is also related. It's all, they're all these words are related. And the core idea here in this text is that it all indicates a turning away from the logical, correct path or approach. Please continue. Where it says, indeed.
Indeed, our sages of blessed memory joined these two ideas. As the Talmud states, a person does not sin unless the spirit of folly enters him, meaning that divergence is the same idea as folly, which is the departure from the way of truth and the way of good. This means that when a person wishes to transgress the ways of Torah and to follow after the desire of his heart and all the humanly pleasures, it is the result of his evil inclination telling him that this pleasure before him is something good and that it is a delight to the eye.
Now that quote, by the way, is from Genesis, where it talks about what the serpent says to Eve and what she sees, what she's convinced by him, looks like a pleasure to the eyes. Continue.
With regard to the sin of the tree of knowledge. And the woman saw that the tree was good for food and that it was a delight to the eyes. So she took of the fruit and she ate, and she gave also to her husband with her, and he ate. In truth, such a perception is a terrible folly, for is this the goodness of a human being, the chosen of all creatures? Wait.
Yeah, you're good.
The chosen of all creatures ought to pursue.
Right, so he's asking a rhetorical question. This is a folly. It's like you should be running after forbidden fruit. Like that's what a human being should be running after. Something that grows in a tree. That should be like consuming us. It's a pleasure. That should be pleasure. It says, she saw, and also Adam, right? Adam and Eve, they saw that the tree was good. It was a delight to the eyes. Pleasure. It's a pleasure. That's pleasure? Pleasure is food? For a human being? I get it for an animal. For a human being, that should be like, that should be what we're running after? Food? Doesn't make any sense. So that's what he says. In truth, such a perception is a terrible folly. It's shtuyot. It's a shtut. Shita. It's turning. It's satan. It's yetzahara. It's nachat. It's turning off from the correct path. And he asks rhetorically, for is this the goodness that a human being who is bechir hanavraim, the chosen of all creatures, that a human being should pursue? That's how he ends that little excerpt from this discourse. So what we see, and by the way, we're going to have many excerpts from this discourse as we develop the theme further tonight. So the first point that we're getting is that anytime a person does something wrong, something that they recognize to be wrong, let's say in retrospect or whatever, even in the moment. So how does a person do it? If a person knows, in other words, anytime a person could look back later and say, what was I thinking? So it's a good question. So what were you thinking? Right? If you could say later on, what was I thinking? So then, in the moment, what were you thinking? And how come you weren't thinking? I'm not asking accusers, I'm asking a real question. In other words, if we can have clarity, if there are moments of clarity, what about the moments of lack of clarity? What's happening? So, it says here in this book of Hasidic philosophy, that, and based on other sources, that what's happening, well, too much wine, maybe, but what's really happening is that inside you have the same serpent, the same snake in the Garden of Eden, but it's now inside. It's the Yetzirah, it's the Satan, and it's what pulls us off from the Derech HaYashar, from the straight and from the correct path. In other words, we know, more or less, we know right and wrong. And when we're doing something wrong, it's typically because of this formula. It's typically because we say, yeah, it's wrong, but it looks so good. But it looks tempting. Yeah, what could go wrong? Let's throw caution to the wind, right? We'll deal with it later. Whatever it is, any of those types of calculations. And by the way, in this text, Kunsh to mind, we once taught it here. We did a Sunday morning Kabbalah and Coffee. I think it was like almost 2 years. It's a very thick, usually we do thin volumes. It was a thick volume. We did it a number of years ago. Unbelievable. It was probably like a few years that it actually took us to go through it, huh? It was called Overcoming Folly. Big green book. Yeah, Overcoming Folly. Overcoming Folly. That's the folly. That's the whole thing. In this book, he explores, like, I think 10 or 12 different levels of folly. A person tells themselves, it's not so bad. Or, okay, it is so bad, but I deserve it. Or, maybe I don't deserve it, but no one will find out about it. Or, they'll find out about it, but I can recover from it. You tell yourself these narratives, but the point is there's always a narrative. And we might not even be aware of the narrative, but there always needs to be a narrative, or else we wouldn't do it. Because we would know better. The premise of this is that the mind is logical, and the mind knows what's right and wrong. I mean, hopefully. And when we get caught up in something unfitting for us, it's because of the serpent, this inner serpent, if you will. And we can't blame it on the serpent because it's not outside of us anymore. It's inside of us. So it's this inner serpent convincing us, it's our part of ourselves convincing us that it's not so bad. Come on, you like it. Try it. What's the big deal? What could go wrong? Etc. So this reminds me of a story. There was a father in back in Russia. So the custom of many men is to go to the mikveh, the ritual bath, of ritual immersion bath, every single morning before prayer, to immerse in a mikveh. Yeah, for additional purity. So they have in Jewish communities, there's a women's mikveh and a men's mikveh. So many men use it every week. Some maybe every Shabbat, every Friday afternoon before Shabbat. Okay. For sure, on the eve of Yom Kippur, it says it's a mitzvah, code of Jewish law, it's a mitzvah to go into the mikveh. But anyway, so here we have a story of, back in Russia, so you had lakes. You had natural bodies of water. But in Russia in the winter, it's frozen. So to go to mikveh every morning, what do you have to do? To break the ice. And you go in, you get out, and you freeze. So they tell a story. It's a true story. There was a Chabad chassid, a Chabadnik, who takes his kid, young boy, decides one day to take him to mikveh. Take him to the lake. I'm not advocating for the safety of the frozen lake. I'm not walking on the lake. Let's make sure that's safe before you... Don't try this at home. Okay. Breaks the ice. He gets in. He gets out. He's got a fluffy towel, whatever they had back then. Who knows? In Russia, maybe they hugged the bear. I don't know. Then he takes the kid. And he puts the kid in, takes him out. And the kid screams, ah, it's free, it's like, maybe it was ooh. Yeah, it was ooh, it's so cold. And then, right into the water, ooh, and then the father wraps him in a warm towel, I don't know how it was warm, whatever, that's how the story goes, and the child said, ah. And the father said, this is a good learning moment, teaching moment, learning moment. There are certain things in life that begin with an ooh and end with an ah. Those are the good things. The things that begin with an ah and end with an ooh, those are not the good things. Right? Certain things, they're difficult. Right, Marnie? Like you said. Everyone wants to go to heaven, but no one wants to die. So certain times... to do the right thing sometimes is difficult. And there's an ooh involved. Like mikveh's cold. And waking up to go to shul in the morning is difficult. Like, it's not easy. There's an ooh there. But later on, there's an ah. Because you know you did the right thing. Whereas the things that are the ah, because they're pleasurable in the moment, those are the ones that sometimes end up with the ooh, like, what was I thinking? That's when you get the bill later on. And the bill hits, and it's like, ay, what was I thinking? What were you thinking? It says right here, you weren't thinking. You were not thinking with your right mind. In other words, there was something in your mind that convinced you, not a big deal, whatever it is, and that pulled you off the straight and narrow. Now, he says at the end of this reading, some amazing ideas. That this is this the goodness that a human being should aspire to? So let's play on that theme. And I want to do this class a little bit out of order because I feel like I want to remix this. I'm the DJ tonight and we're going to text number 9. We're going to come back to text 7, but first text number 9. David.
Everything that was created in this world serves some purpose, and that purpose is to ascend to a level higher than its own.
So let me interrupt you for a second. This is an amazing idea, and this is from the same text, Kuntrasamayan, Overcoming Folly in the English. He says, everything that exists shares a common purpose, a general common purpose, and that is to go higher. Nothing is to remain stagnant, it's all to elevate and to ascend to the next level. And he defines that. Continue.
For example, the purpose of a plant is fulfilled when it is consumed and thus elevated by animal, and the purpose of the animal is fulfilled when it is consumed and elevated by man. And the purpose of man is fulfilled when his spirit is elevated to and one.
I think it becomes one.
Two and becomes one with the spiritual levels that are above.
So here we have this notion that the plant becomes part of the animal. It's almost like, you can start from the earth. The earth nurtures, gives nutrients to the plants, and the plants feed the animals, and the animals feed the human beings. And the human beings, they're meant to rise higher in the realm of spirit. How do we do that? How do we do that? What's the formula? So take a look at text number 10. Alex, please read text number 10. Here he talks about, again, same discourse. It's really long. There's lots of insights in here. In a different section, he talks about different forms of pleasure.
There are various types of pleasures, such as the pleasure of eating tasty food, which is the lowliest pleasure. It is truly animalistic. For an animal pursues only what it naturally perceives as good and enjoyable. It doesn't know of any goodness other than this.
So he says like this, the pleasure that one gets from eating, animals also get that same pleasure. You like a steak, animals also like a steak, raw. You like sushi, yeah, the animals also eat grass. It's like the same, it's similar, it's eating. It's not a human pleasure. Continue.
Above this is more spiritual pleasure, such as listening to beautiful music.
So this is already higher, because when was the last time you saw giraffes playing Mozart? It's not something that they're typically doing. I've seen that before, huh? Yeah, in Little Einstein or Baby Einstein, when they played the classical music for the babies, they sometimes had these animals. All right, continue.
Above this is the pleasure that comes with fine character traits, such as the tremendous pleasure from doing acts of goodness and kindness for
another. So I'm going to jump in again. So he says, like, there's another pleasure that people get from doing good for another. So you give to someone else and you feel good about giving. That's a human pleasure. That's a higher pleasure. He's ranking pleasures from lowest to highest. Eating, that's basic. Anyone can do that, even animals. Music, higher. Doing a favor for another, or being a mensch, that's even higher. Even higher than that, continue.
Okay. Now, above all these pleasures is the pleasure found in intellect and wisdom, such as in developing a new idea, which brings tremendous pleasure. Likewise, grasping and properly understanding the concept brings great pleasure to the soul. And this is the true and ultimate pleasure, goodness and pleasure, a condition that the wisdom itself is good and true. For if it is evil wisdom, it is forbidden to study. The goodness and pleasure of man, as the chosen of all creatures, must be in such spiritual matters, and specifically in matters of wisdom. This ought to be one's soul's pleasure, for this is what places man above all other creatures, the intellect he has. And specifically, from the perspective of the godly soul, which stems from God's wisdom, one ought to pursue the wisdom of Torah and find its pleasure therein. One's soul will therefore be elevated to the exalted level from which it was created.
And this is how human beings ascend higher. So this is what he says, to connect this with the previous text. Everything exists to rise above itself, its natural state. Plants are meant to rise to the level of animals. Animals are meant to rise to the level of humans. And humans are meant to rise to the level of the divine. Everything is meant to jump up a level. How do we rise to the level of the divine? Not by eating food, not even by listening to music, and not even by being a mensch to someone else. But it's through the way he describes it here, intellect, chachma, wisdom, that is a unique human pleasure. And he says, specifically when it comes to Torah wisdom, God's wisdom, that raises a person to the level of divine. Now within that itself, the same author, the Rebbe Rashab, the fifth Chabad Rebbe, he writes in text 11, which I'll read, he writes that within Torah study, studying the secrets of Torah, the mystical dimensions of Torah, Kabbalah and Chassidut, that's the most divine within the divine study of Torah. In other words, within the divine experience, pleasure of studying Torah, God's wisdom. It's not just wisdom. So it's not eating, it's not music, it's not fine character traits, it's not even wisdom, it's Torah wisdom, and it's not even Torah wisdom generally, it's specifically inner wisdom of Torah, the deepest wisdom of Torah, the godly wisdom of Torah, which is Chassidus and Kabbalah. So here we go, text 11. The very fact, and look how he describes the power of studying what we tend to study here, the mystical dimensions of Torah. The very fact of understanding the concepts of Chassidus in the mind, even before working to apply the concepts to one's divine service, there should be another M dash there, transform one's faculties from corporeal to godly. In other words, you can transform your nature by just the pure study of Hasidic philosophy, not even before you actually apply it and live it. Even before you apply it, the very study can transform one's character. By understanding godliness through abstract application of the soul's faculties, these faculties become godly. When one finds himself on a faraway island, remote from any other people, and he does nothing but contemplate concepts of Chassidus, in case you're ever shipwrecked, you know what to do, God forbid, right? He is greatly elevated. Through his involvement in Chassidus, he becomes removed from corporeality and becomes godly. When he contemplates such subjects, he truly is higher and loses his connection to the physical. So a person can actually elevate to a higher plane. We're talking about elevating to the next level up. That happens through specifically the wisdom, chachma, Torah, and specifically Chassidus. Okay, so now the question is like this. So when he said before that what is a sin, definition of sin, or the definition of folly really, is turning away from that normative, logical path of goodness and the right thing and going down a negative path. So how does it come about? And he said, rhetorically, he says, is this really what a person should be pursuing? Eating of the forbidden fruit? You have so many more important things to take care of. So many more. You have a mission to rise ever higher, to touch the loftiest dimensions, and you're running after something, not only the lowest pleasure, the lowest category of pleasure, food, but within that pleasure, that which you're not supposed to have. I mean, come on. That's really what you're running after, Adam and Eve? Seriously. You're meant to go higher, and here you are at the lowest level, groveling in low stuff. So how does that happen? So how do we make such a mistake? Is the snake that good? And how does the snake operate? So let's turn back. This is where the remix comes in. Let's turn back. Let's jump back to text number 7. I'll read this one as well. Text number 7. The Talmud says how the Yetzirah, the evil inclination, operates, how the snake operates. Look at this. That is the craft of the evil inclination. Today it tells him do this, and tomorrow it tells him do that, and until eventually it tells him worship idols, and he goes and worships idols. In other words, and we had a different explanation of this a few weeks ago, but let's stick with the basic explanation, which we'll cover tonight, and that is, it happens little by little. First, the Yetzirah says, do this, and then do that, and then, do the big thing. So it's gradual, right? It's gradual. If something goes off course, right? If a runner goes off course, or if a tree grows off course, it happened because at one point in time it went a millimeter off, right? If you're manufacturing something, and you're trying to create something precision, you're creating a watch, you're creating something that has precision machine tooling, and you're off by a little bit. I mean, it's a big problem. And if you're aiming somewhere and you're off by a millimeter down the line, it's a very vast distance. So the point is, how does the Yetzirah operate? How does the snake operate? It operates slowly. And the way it's described in the commentaries and in Hasidic philosophy as well, the way it's described is that first, the evil inclination doesn't tell us to serve idols, to do something forbidden. It just says, enjoy the material. So for example, when it comes to eating, right? So we all have to eat. Can't survive without eating. The Yetzirah will say, indulge in the food. Really enjoy the food. Get into it, right? Become very much involved in it. And the more we become involved in materialism, even if it's okay, even if it's permitted, even if it's kosher materialism, but the more materialistic we are, the less spiritually sensitive we are. And once we're less spiritual, because it's almost like a balance. It's like, you know, it's like on a pivot. It's like a seesaw. It is what it is. It's really hard to be super sensitive to the nuance of the steak, and also be super sensitive to the nuance of prayer. It theoretically it's possible, but practically it's usually not like that. It's usually the more materialistic we are, the less spiritually sensitive we are. And once we lose that spiritual sensitivity, then we become prone to ultimately, using the language of the Talmud, serving idols. Even if it doesn't literally mean serving idols, but whatever that idol is for us. So where it starts is the losing the sensitivity toward spirituality. And how does that start? by gaining sensitivity to the material. That's how it approaches step by step. So I'm going to read one more text. Text number 8. Here we go. And then we're going to have the big finish. Text 8. It is well known that an over-nurtured animal soul weakens the godly soul. As the saying goes, strong body equals a weak soul. It doesn't mean you can't work, you can't take care of your body, but it means if you indulge in the body, it weakens the soul. Namely, intense corporeality of the animal soul weakens the godly soul. When this occurs, in other words, when a person is now immersed in materialism, one drifts away from Torah, there should be a word there, Torah and prayer. For it is impossible for such a person to truly understand and meditate upon godly concepts and be driven by them to cleave to God, etc. All of this is completely out of such a person's league. In other words, if a person finds that they're trying to focus in prayer and concentrate on God and have a spiritual experience and it's not going, the Rebbe Rashab says, look in the mirror. Are you indulging in materialism? If you're a materialist, it's probably not going to happen that you'll be a spiritualist. It's probably not going to be in the same conversation. If you want to have more spiritual sensitivity, we have to lose a little bit of sensitivity toward the materialism, toward the physicality of it all. But aside from that, he says, this spiritual numbness causes one to lose fear of God, to forget about godliness, so that the fact that something opposes God's will doesn't stop him from doing it. For God and his will are not tangibly felt in his soul. In other words, it could continue to go where a person not only can't daven properly or can't study Torah and have a divine experience from studying Torah, but a person might also begin to lose sensitivity to stop caring, God forbid, about what Hashem wants. A person says, yeah, it's what God wants. All right, I also want things. That lack of sensitivity, he says, is all born from the first step of pursuing materialism, even permitted materialism. Let's continue. Though one does not deny the existence of God and the truth of the Torah, God forbid, and he knows the Torah is true and that the matter at hand is forbidden by the Torah, he still doesn't feel the prohibition in a way that prevents him from doing it, and that motivates him to overcome his desires. That's not what happens. He doesn't feel it to motivate him to overcome his desires. Rather, he lets the desires take over. This is all because, what's the source? Over-engrossment in permissible pleasures. This is all because over-engrossment and permissible pleasures have greatly bolstered his animal soul and greatly weakened his godly soul. Therefore, when his animal soul tempts him and shows him the allure of the forbidden matter, though it is outright forbidden, he is drawn after it and succumbs. God forbid, it is thus understood quite simply how one is tricked into the false goodness of something that in truth is utterly evil, which drags the soul far down, God forbid. And what he's saying here is, how can a person do something that's so utterly wrong, that so utterly goes against the grain of who they are? It happens slowly. I'll give you the best example that I can think of on a human level. Someone's in a relationship, in a committed relationship with somebody, and they do something to completely violate the trust of that relationship, right? So to do that means many things, but one thing that it also means is that they probably went on a process for themselves where they lost sensitivity to the other person. I don't mean sensitive. What I mean is that they became into themselves or into other whatever it is, but it didn't happen in one day. In other words, didn't happen. Somebody who cares about someone doesn't hurt them. Someone who hurt them, it means that somehow they lost that sensitivity to really care. So somebody does something that they know is against what Hashem wants. How does it happen? It happens because slowly a person became desensitized to think about and to that it should be relevant to them what God indeed wants. So what he's saying here is that this is what the Talmud means, that the Yetzirah's craft is today do this, tomorrow do that, and then serve idols. It means there's a slow and steady progression until it gets to that point. So what does this have to do with the snake and the laws of kosher? If you recall, the snake is referred to as crawling on its belly. And as Rashi said, it doesn't mean just crawling on its belly. Take a look at text number 12. Text 12 is a repeat of an earlier text. Rashi's commentary. I'm going to read this one as well. I'll just read the next few texts until we close this out. Huh? Yeah. Okay, so the next one or two. Text 12, page 20, that goes on its belly. Rashi says in our Torah portion, this is the snake. Listen to this. The word gachon denotes bending low. Let's skip the brackets. Because it moves while bent in a prostrated posture, prostrated on its belly. Rashi says two things. It goes bent over, bent toward the ground, and prostrated on its belly. Two things. Rashi doesn't say it's prostrated on its belly. It says it's a prostrated posture, and then it goes on its belly. And the way it's understood is that Rashi is describing the process of the snake. First, you bend down a little bit, and then you find yourself all the way on the ground, slithering, running after the dust, running after the lowest things. Rashi doesn't say right away, bending low, prostrated on its belly. It says first, it's better in the Hebrew. Rashi says, Shaholech Shach, he goes bending down. Vinofa Ameav, number one. Number two, he's falling, he's going on his stomach. Two things, bending low and going on his belly. Why not just one thing on the belly? Because it doesn't happen so fast. We're talking about the snake. The way the snake operates is, first it moves you down, and then it gets you all the way down. In other words, the first thing is, you start looking down. What does that mean, looking down? Remember what we learned? What should everything be doing always? Ascending. Where should we be looking? To the rung above us. If we're on this ladder of life, and everything is meant to climb, you don't climb by looking down, you climb by looking up. The snake says, yeah, you'll climb tomorrow. Right now, look down, there's some good steak. I know I'm using steak a lot. Whatever. I don't even like steak. It says, look down, look at the materialism. So the first thing that it does is gets you hooked on materialism, even permitted materialism, but it gets you stuck in the earth. It gets you focused on the earth. And once you're there, it's easy. That's the first step off the, right? We said that how do you get a hundred miles off course? By turning a millimeter, right? And eventually you get all the way off course. How do we get ourselves off where we need to be? It's by that first looking down. And then you end up, a person might end up on one's belly, so to speak, all the way down to the ground. And that is how the snake operates. Let's take a look at text 13. Here's how the Rebbe explains it. This is the last text, page 21. The sages teach that the snake is the evil inclination. The Torah is telling us that the evil inclination's first step is not to turn a person into one who walks on his belly. Doesn't jump for the kill right away, but rather to turn a person into one who moves while bent in a prostrated posture. This means a person whose head hangs lowly, he lacks the, quote, raise up your eyes and see who created all this. They're not looking up. The snake says, look down, and you look down, you listen to the snake. But ultimately, this results, God forbid, in one who falls on his belly. As the sages have said, that is the craft of the evil inclination. Today it tells him, do this, tomorrow do that, until eventually it tells him, worship idols. The solution to withstand the snake is by staying involved with lofty matters, the study of Torah, and specifically the study of Chassidus, the innermost parts of the Torah, Kabbalah, mysticism, etc. So here we have the whole class coming together. The snake is singled out, and there's a break with a snake, because there are things that you can't eat, and then there's a snake. And it's not the same category. The things that we're not meant to eat, yeah, whatever, has a negative influence on us, or it might, whatever. But the snake is much more cunning. The snake is much more daring and much more dangerous than those other types, than the forbidden animals, and the forbidden birds, and the forbidden fish. The snake is much more dangerous, because the snake's agenda is to get us all the way down, like it did with Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden, got them expelled from that very garden. So we have to be very careful. We have to know what it means within ourselves. We have to be mindful of where we are at each moment. Are we looking up? Are we looking down? Look, we are not tzaddikim. At least I can speak for myself. I'm not a tzaddik. And therefore, we're always going to have moments in which we find ourselves looking down. The point is to be aware of it and to quickly correct it and look back up. Because the more we look down, the more we're likely to, God forbid, fall. So we don't want to do that. So the message of the class, so we've answered the question. Number one, why is it separated with a break? To show the uniqueness. Why is it referred to as in the euphemism and not directly snake? That which crawls on its belly, or that which browses down on a crawl? To tell us what is the problem with the snake. It's not just a snake is not kosher. It's because of what it represents. And why does Rashi split it up into two points? Because, again, it's a two-step or a multi-step process. It's a gradual process of lowering a human being down. So again, the antidote to this is remaining connected with that which is higher. So whether it's music or whether it's good character traits or wisdom, I mean, we should try to keep on climbing that ladder of pleasure to go to ever higher pleasures. But when it comes to wisdom, the wisdom of Torah, and within Torah, the wisdom of the deeper insights of Torah, this is what keeps us focused on the task at hand and our mission in life, which is to ascend ever higher. Make sense? Thank you very much for joining me tonight for Torah studies.